Shalom, Hadavarniks. It's good to have you here for our next session, session 5 of The Romans and Russians Are Coming, Oh My. Session 5 is also session 48 of the First Regathering Modern Israel, so you can pick up this class at either location on the web. All right, before we get into the new material in session 5, let's do a quick review of where we were. We are in the Russians section of the class. We're covering Ezekiel chapters 38 and 39. Now, as we started Ezekiel 38 and 39, I directed you to some comments made by Dr. Thomas Ice in regard to these chapters. And he came up with some rather disappointing and concerning comments. The key comment that we read was his statement that the emerging evangelical scholarly view is that prophecy should not, capital N-O-T, should not be taken literally, as has been done by dispensationalists. Well, I am a dispensationalist, and make no apology for that. So we will be taking this section, Ezekiel 38 and 39, literally. He goes on, speaking of the modern scholarly evangelical consensus, they may not be able to tell you what these sections of Scripture actually mean, but this one thing they know. Prophecy should not be interpreted literally. So if that's the case, you're not interpreting prophecy literally, I mean, the world is the limit. The sky is the limit. You can make the Scripture mean anything you want it to mean, because the literal method is the historical grammatical approach. And we will be using the historical grammatical approach in this class. They go on to say that prophecy is primarily about ideas and principles, not future historical events. Well, it is true that prophecy is about ideas and principles, but prophecy also includes a lot of historical events, future historical events. So we'll be looking at Ezekiel 38 and 39, not only concerned about ideas and principles, but also concerned with the idea and supporting the idea that future historical events are in view as well. Well, we looked at the prophetic time frames of Ezekiel. Ezekiel would often look at his prophet's present time. He would look at the near future. He discusses the Messiah's first coming. He discusses the tribulation period, the second coming, and the kingdom. Now, in chapter 37, verses 15 through 28, he was in the kingdom. And now, as we move into chapter 38, verse 1 through 39, verse 16, he talks about the Messiah's first coming, and he begins to dabble in the tribulation as well. Now, as we began the class and looked at the first two verses, the participants in a massive, massive military alliance are named. First of all, Magog, thought to inhabit the area between the Black and Caspian Sea. However, other scholars see Magog in central Turkey. So in this map, I have Magog in between the Caspian and Black Sea in the southern Russia, and also with a question mark, and also Magog in Turkey. So scholars are not sure exactly where Magog should be located. Some scholars feel that Magog traveled. The Magogites emigrated to the area we call Kazakhstan today, or through southern Russia. But whatever, we have a strong association of Magog with Russia, perhaps Turkey. But anyway, this same general area around the Black and Caspian Sea. It was also noted that Rosh is the basis for the name Russia. Not all commentators agree with that association. That association is quite reasonable. Next, we looked at Meshech again on this particular table of nations from the ESV Study Bible, locates Meshech in northeastern Turkey today. However, that's not the only place the scholars think Meshech is located, not only in northeastern Turkey but also in central Turkey and southern Turkey as well. So Meshech is a question mark as well. We're not exactly sure where the people from Meshech live. But we also noted that some scholars feel that the word Meshech became the basis for the name of the capital of Russia, Moskva. Again, not everybody agrees with that analysis. The next nation we looked at was Tubal, here on this map, located in central southern Turkey. But other scholars, not only located in central southern Turkey, but as you see on the map, in southeastern Turkey as well. And some scholars associate the name Tubal with the town of Tobolsk in Siberia. They say that Tubal gave its name, was the basis for the name Tobolsk in Siberia. Tobolsk was a very important city. It was the capital of Siberia, and the final czars, the last czarist assassination occurred there in Tobolsk. So not everybody agrees with that association as well. But as far as the Jewish community is concerned, we have at least four associations with Russia. We have Magog, southern Russia, Rosh, northern Russia, Meshech, Moscow, and Tubal with Tobolsk. We also talked a little bit about the two Messiah theory. The rabbis could never put together the conquering Messiah and the suffering Messiah. They felt they were contradictory views, and they couldn't rationalize them. They couldn't harmonize them. And so they came up with the two Messiah theory, that two Messiahs would come. Mashiach ben Yosef, Messiah son of Joseph, was the suffering Messiah. And Messiah son of David, Mashiach ben David, would be the conquering Messiah. Mashiach ben Yosef would come first, and he would die in the wars of Gog and Magog. So they associated Gog and Magog in Ezekiel 38:39 with the Messiah. It's considered a messianic section in Scripture. Now, the rabbis also have another tradition that when you see the Russian Navy passing through the Bosphorus on the way to the Dardanelles, that is, out of the Black Sea, through the water route, through the Bosphorus and the Dardanelles to the Mediterranean Sea, when you see the Russian Navy traveling in that direction, in order to attack Israel, put on your Shabbat clothes, because the Messiah is close at hand. And so we have another association in Jewish thinking with Russia, and these verses and Russia. This final association is the rabbis associate verses 1 and 2 with the Russian Navy. So we have a lot of Russian associations there. Then I asked you to go ahead and read the handout. Ezekiel 38 and 39, part 3 by Thomas Ice, dealing with the identification of Rosh. And he presents the case very clearly. All right, that brings us now to verses 3 and 4 of chapter 38 and the declaration that God makes against Gog. And this is in verse 3, Ezekiel 38:3. Ezekiel is to say to Gog, "Thus says the Lord God, Behold, I am against you, O Gog, prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal." So God singles out this world leader for judgment. A very particular world leader can be identified very clearly, and he is singled out for judgment. Now his preparation for the invasion is brought out in verse 4, Ezekiel 38:4. God says, "I will turn you about and put hooks in your jaws, and I will bring you out, and all your army, horses and horsemen, all of them splendidly attired, a great company with buckler and shield, all of them wielding swords." God says to Gog, "I will turn you about." In other words, Gog will be diverted away from a planned attack in another direction. And instead, he's going to move south against Israel. "I will turn you about." Well, what could that be? Well, here's a map of Russia, and here is the most logical gathering place for the coalition. This little arm of Russia coming down to the south, just north of the Caucasus Mountains between the Black and Caspian Seas. This is the most logical place. Now, what could be on Gog's mind? Could he be thinking of moving west against the Ukraine? When I did this class many years ago, everything was pretty peaceful. Everything was pretty peaceful going on. But now in 2015, we see all kinds of rebellion and military movement and war, civil war in the Ukraine. A lot of it's sparked by Russia. So that's a very logical hotspot, even looking at today's news. Whether it will be in when this actually happens, we don't know, but it's possible. So he could be putting together a coalition with the appearance of heading to the west, into the Ukraine, perhaps. Or what if he puts together a coalition and it looks like he needs to head east into Kazakhstan? Kazakhstan is a Russian client state. Could they rebel? Could they be uppity and be throwing off the Russian influence? Possibly. We don't know. But whatever the case, he's going to probably gather in southern Russia, just north of the Caucasus Mountains, and instead of the attack going one way or another, suddenly God will turn him about, and little Israel will be his target. Here's little Israel at the bottom of this map in the white. There's Russia in the north. Will he? It'll appear perhaps that he's going to the west. It may appear that he's going to the east, but that won't happen. Instead, his forces will be dragged by God south to attack little Israel. They will move south against Israel, and it apparently will be a surprise attack. Catch the rest of the world off guard. God says on point two in your outline, I will put hooks in your jaws. This means that Gog could do nothing else. God will drag him to his doom. In fact, Gog is pictured as a monster with hooks in his jaws. And I thought this picture of an alligator was a rather appropriate illustration of Gog. Here is an animal with monster jaws, a very powerful and dangerous animal, just like Russia will be. But God will put a hook in those jaws, and he will drag this monster to its doom. Well, there's the fate of Gog. And the third point in your outline, God says, I will bring you forth. Please note that. That's a mark it up moment. God is bringing this invasion about. So the sovereignty of God is in view very clearly here. God is doing this. He says, I will bring you about with all your army, horses, horsemen, a great company, buckler and shield and swords. Now God is speaking in terms Ezekiel and his contemporaries can understand. Now Ezekiel and those who would follow Ezekiel for the next couple of thousand years would be able to understand that God is talking about a well-equipped military force here. He's talking about a literal army. It's only been the last 100 years or so that bucklers and shields and swords and horses and horsemen have not been used in modern warfare. But those of us who live in the age of modern warfare definitely understand that this describes a well-equipped military force, a literal army. And so did those who precede us. So I think God is just speaking to Ezekiel in terms that Ezekiel and his contemporaries and those who come after him can understand. And so I do believe this is a literal army being described here. All right, the allies of Gog are listed in verses 5 and 6. Persia, Ethiopia, and Put with them, all of them with shield and helmet, Gomer and all its troops, Beth Togarma from the remote parts of the north with all its troops, many peoples with you. All right, the first ally, the first major contributor to this military alliance is Persia. Persia is a son of Japhet from Madai, Genesis 10:2 and 1 Chronicles 1:4. Today, Persia is modern Iran. So as you look on the map here, look on the right side, and the dark greenish-blue area is Iran or ancient Persia. So Iran will be part of this coalition. The next coalition partner is Cush. Cush was the son of Ham in Genesis 10:6. Now, Cush is also biblical Ethiopia, but biblical Ethiopia is not the Ethiopia we know today. In fact, it was modern North Sudan would be a better location for Cush or biblical Ethiopia. So on our map, you see this green area. That is modern northern Sudan. That would be the Cushites. The next member of the coalition is Put, also another son of Ham in Genesis 10:6. Now, this is either Somalia or Somaliland. Now, Somaliland is on the east of Africa. It's the Horn of Africa. You can see it there at the lower right corner of your map. That's Put. But we're not exactly sure if that is the location of Put. It's also possible that it could be Libya, a reference to Libya. Now, Libya is in North Africa, in the center of North Africa, and you can see it here in the pretty much the middle of your map. So, again, the question marks regarding the location of Put. Now, God goes on to describe the army of Put as all of them with shield and helmet. So all of these three nations, Persia, Cush, and Put, are prepared for war. They're prepared to join the Northern Coalition. They will all make significant military contributions to this military force. The next partner in the coalition is Gomer, another son of Japhet in Genesis 10:2. Now in Breshit Rabbah 37:1, a Jewish commentary, Gomer is spelled Germania, Germany. In the Talmud, it's also indicated to be Germania. So from a Jewish perspective, the next participant in this army will be Germany. So up in Europe, I've put the word Gomer with a question mark. Why? Some feel that it would be Germany. Others feel that it would be the Ukraine. So whether it turns out to be Germany or the Ukraine, this is the only European nation mentioned, Gomer. And again, he's described as all his hordes, so he will have numerous men in his army. He will make a significant contribution to the coalition. The next point, F, the house of Togarma. This is a grandson of Japhet through Gomer in Genesis 10:3. Now, Togarma is located in Armenia and possibly Turkey. So here, the red circle is the Armenia area, and Togarma below it is close to Turkey. So Togarma may be located in the same area we have looked at those other nations. Again, Togarma is described as all his hordes, so he will make a contribution, a large contribution to the army. Now, the location of Togarma is laid out here, in the uttermost parts of the north. Now, in this verse, this comment specifically refers to Togarma, which is north of Israel, by the way, but is not in the uttermost parts of the north of Israel. But in chapter 38, verse 15, and then in chapter 39, verse 2, this phrase will refer to the whole invading army. The whole invading army will come from the uttermost parts of the north. And again, from Israel, the uttermost part of the north is Russia. On your map here, you can see the arrow pointing to the name on the map, Russia. Russia is due north of Israel, and guess what? If you go due north from Jerusalem, here in the bottom left of your map, the red circle is Israel. You go due north, and we're going due north here, and you run smack dab into Moscow. Moscow, the capital of Russia, due north, directly due north of Jerusalem. And if you continue north, you continue to the uttermost parts of the north. You continue through Russia till the Arctic, till you run out of land at the Arctic oceans and Arctic seas up there. So Russia goes all the way north as far as land can go. So apparently, the armies will gather in Russia, somewhere in here. Again, I think the most logical place would be the little arm of Russia coming down south, just north of the Caucasus Mountains. That seems to be the most logical place for the armies to gather. Apparently to attack somewhere. Apparently to attack some other location. But by surprise, they then suddenly move south. God moves them south against little Israel. Through Georgia, through Turkey, through Syria. That seems to be a very logical path as well against Israel. Now, God also goes on to describe this invasion as even many peoples with you. Now, this statement can be understood two ways. Number one, it may refer to the numbers of people already mentioned, to the hordes of Togarma and others. Or it may refer to other nations not mentioned, other coalition partners, the minor members of the coalition. So it could be that just the major members are named and the minor members not named. So we'll see. We'll have to see how this works out. If we get to see this invasion, we will probably understand that phrase a lot better. So let's make some observations. Dr. Fruchtenbaum makes three key observations here. Now, before we go into these observations, remember there are three basic biblical breakdowns of humanity. You know, we're all in the same human race, we're all of the same human family, but that humanity is broken down into three basic families. And these are the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Those are the three families, the three basic families of the earth. So all of us fit into one of those families. Now notice, there are six Japhethite nations mentioned and two Hamite nations mentioned, but no Semitic nations mentioned. Six descended from Japheth, two descended from Ham, but none descended from Shem. Now, unless they play a minor role in this attack, not a single Arab state is part of the invasion. Now, it's possible that an Arab state could be part of it and be playing a minor role so that they're not even named. But no single Arab nation is named. So it's possible that none of the Arabs take part in this invasion. Now, you might object. You might say, well, what about Libya? You know, Libya is northern Africa, and the Muslims invaded that area. Well, that's true, but Libya is mostly Berber people. Libya is not particularly Arab. It's mostly Berber. All right, let's go on to the next point, a comment you would find in the Art Scroll Commentary. The Art Scroll Commentary, it's a Jewish and Orthodox Jewish commentary on Ezekiel 38 and 39. Has this comment, Yerushalami Megillah 3:9 renders Magog as the Goths, G-O-T-H-S, the Goths, a group of nomadic tribes who destroyed the Scythians and made their homes in Scythian territory. Considering that the Goths were Germanic people, the identification of Magog's descendants is in accord with Targum Yonathan on Genesis 10:2, which renders Magog as Germania, which in Bereshit Rabbah is also given as Germania, or Hebrew for Germany. So we have a traditional Jewish association of Magog with Germany as well as with Russia. So that makes it look like the hypothesis that Germany is a Gomer, much more possible. So we'll see what happens. We'll see exactly what nations join in this coalition. But on this idea that Germany might be one of the coalition partners, let's ask a question. Is Germany anti-Semitic today? You know, Germany was definitely anti-Semitic in the during World War II, in the late 30s and early 40s. Definitely anti-Semitic. But then they seem to have repented of their anti-Semitism. But so is Germany anti-Semitic today? Could they possibly be one of those coalition partners? Well, here's an article that I just came across recently, March 3rd, 2015, from the Huffington Post, Germany. The title, Anti-Semitism is on the Rise in German Schools. And here's a few excerpts from this article. Munich. Scrawling swastikas on synagogues. Jew baiting during demonstrations. Desecration of Jewish cemeteries. Once again, 75 years after the Holocaust, hatred against Jews is taking place openly in Germany, even in schools. There it is, you guys. Current figures from the German government show that the anti-Semitism is not only a perception. The number of crimes linked to anti-Semitism in Germany increased dramatically over the last year. You know, it's not just something we're thinking about. It has facts behind it. It has incidents piling up. While 788 cases were registered in 2013, there were 864 cases registered in 2014, a 10% increase. In German schoolyards, the word Jew is increasingly used as an insult, etc. The article went on, a pretty disturbing article. Is there anti-Semitism in Germany today? I think this article shows us that anti-Semitism is alive and well in that nation once again. All right, let's move on to verses 7 through 9, where the place of the invasion is described. The preparation for the invasion is found in verse 7. God says, "Be prepared and prepare yourself, you and all your companies that are assembled about you, and be a guard for them." So God says to Gog, "You be prepared." This is very, very emphatic. Gog, you get ready. Here's what you're supposed to do. And all your companies or all your assemblies that are assembled onto you. It's a play on words there. It works in the English. All your assemblies that are assembled onto you. Be a guard unto them. The word in Hebrew means a guard, a protector, security. In other words, Gog is to take command. He is to be a security and take the general responsibility for the whole army and for the well-being of the soldiers on his shoulders. It is his responsibility. So Gog is going to be the commander-in-chief of this coalition. He's the top guy running the show and telling the army where to go and what tactics to use. He's the top guy. All right, verse 8, the object of the invasion. After many days you will be summoned. In the latter years you will come into the land that is restored from the sword, whose inhabitants have been gathered from many nations to the mountains of Israel, which had been a continual waste. But its people were brought out from the nations, and they are living securely, all of them. All right, the time of the invasion. After many days. Well, Ezekiel was writing around 550 BC, and as I teach this class today, it's 2015, so about at least 1,400 years have passed. Many, many years, a lot longer than that. So many days have passed in the latter years. Now the context is eschatological, the end of the age. So this is going to occur during the time of the last days. Now exactly when in the last days, we'll discuss in chapter 39, verse 16. So we'll get to that. Now the object of the invasion is brought out. You shall come into the land. And then a very accurate description follows. It's a land that has been brought back from the sword. The sword is the 2,000 years of persecution climaxing in the Holocaust of World War II. It's a land that is gathered out of many peoples. This refers to the current worldwide dispersion where Jews have returned to the land from about 80 or 90 countries. The land has mountains. You'll come upon the mountains of Israel, which have been a continual waste. Now, the mountains of Israel are in the West Bank today. Here's a map, a close-up of Israel, and the West Bank is in the center of the map. This is the West Bank in the red circle, and that is the Judean Hills, or the mountains of Israel. There's the key target right there. Now, the mountains of Israel are stated to be a continual waste. Well, this is a picture of the Hill of Evil Council taken in 1894, just as Zionism began to really move along. This is the Hill of Evil Council is in the Judean Hills, just south a little bit of Jerusalem. Notice it's desolate. It's a waste. Hardly anything even growing there. So that's a representative of the Judean Hills, the mountains of Israel, for some 2,000 years. Here are the mountains of Israel today. Here's the Judean hills today. Notice, they're not a continual waste. They are covered with trees. They are covered with grape arbors and olive trees and with settlers. Jewish villages and towns are all over the mountains of Israel today. So things are very, very different today. It's a land brought forth out of the peoples. This is a repetition of the thought that this is a worldwide return, brought out of the peoples, the other nations of the world. And they dwell securely, all of them. Now, the word securely there means confidence. It does not necessarily mean an absence of strife, but it does mean confidence. So this will all occur, this invasion will occur after the first worldwide regathering in unbelief in preparation for the tribulation. This prophecy could not have been fulfilled before 1948 because there was no Jewish state before 1948. But exactly when after 1948, exactly when it will be fulfilled awaits chapter 39, verse 16. But note, at the time of the invasion, Israel will be in possession of the West Bank. The significance? If a Palestinian state is established, it will only be temporary because these are the mountains of Israel. These are not the mountains of Palestine. All right, as I look at my watch, I see that we're right in time for your break. So go ahead and take your break, and we'll be back in just a moment after our break. All right, we're back. Hope you had a good break. All right, now let's pick it up where we left off. We finished up verse 8. Now let's take a look at verse 9 of Ezekiel 38. Ezekiel 38:9 deals with the massiveness or the size of the invasion. Verse 9. You will go up. God is speaking to Gog. You will go up. You will come like a storm. You will be like a cloud covering the land. You and all your troops and many peoples with you. So you will go up or you will ascend. This is not an air attack. Gog is not going up in airplanes and aircraft and attacking Israel. This is simply an idiom for going up to Jerusalem. Whenever you go to Jerusalem, you always have to go up. You always have to climb the Judean hills. Now here's a map of Israel with the West Bank in the center, the Judean hills in the center. And if you go to Jerusalem from the Shvelah, from the coast, you go up. You ascend the Jerusalem hills. If you go to Jerusalem from the Negev, from the south, you go up to Jerusalem. You ascend the Judean hills. Or if you go to Jerusalem from the Jezreel Valley, for example, you go up to Jerusalem. You ascend the Judean hills. So you always go up to Jerusalem or down from Jerusalem. See, the Jewish thinking is centered around Jerusalem, not north or south, like our thinking is centered. It is centered on Jerusalem. So you're always going up to Jerusalem, you're going toward Jerusalem, or you're going down from Jerusalem, you're going away from Jerusalem. But it could be in the direction of any of the points of the compass. And by the way, this term to go up has become the technical term for immigration, aliyah, to go up to immigrate. You're making aliyah, you're going up. Okay, so this is not an air attack. All right, some similes show the massiveness of the invasion. You shall come like a storm. You shall be like a cloud. So the army is pictured as a huge shadow, a huge cloud covering the land. And here's a picture of a massive storm cloud covering the sky from horizon to horizon. That's the picture there. Only this is Gog's hordes, a huge storm cloud about to break over Israel. And those involved in this army are you, that's Gog and Magog, all your hordes, that's the nations over which he is a prince that were named in verses 5 and 6, and then many peoples with you, that probably are the numerous unnamed allies, the numerous unnamed members of the coalition. So here on our map, we have the gathering point. Again, I put a question mark in the gathering point because I don't claim to be a prophet. I'm only operating on logic here, and my logic is not necessarily foolproof. So I put a question mark. This seems to be the logical gathering point for, first of all, from the south, Meshech and Magog and Tubal. Meshech, Magog, and Tubal. Also Persia and Cush and Put and Gomer. And they shall gather somewhere in this area, somewhere in Russia, but God will turn them about and they will come down against little Israel. Come down against Israel. That will be their target. Now some observations by Dr. Fruchtenbaum. First of all, it's basically, this is a summary. Point 4a. The prophecy presupposes that Israel is back in the land. Remember, it couldn't be fulfilled. This prophecy couldn't be fulfilled before 1948 because there's no Jewish state before 1948. So here's a picture, one of those very famous pictures of David Ben-Gurion proclaiming the inception of the State of Israel May 14th, 1948. Now the State of Israel officially became a real entity, a state among the states of the world. Here's the Palestine Post. It now is known as the Jerusalem Post. Here's the headlines of the Palestine Post. The State of Israel is born. And by the way, Palestinians in those days were Jews. They weren't Arabs. Palestinians were anyone basically living in the land, Jews as well as Arabs, Palestinians. So just a little bit of a twist on that history today by the current Palestinians. Now, this return is in unbelief because Israel is saved only after this invasion. And you know, today only 1% of the Jewish community believes in Yeshua, believes in the Messiah. So Israel has returned in unbelief, and only 10 to 15% of the Israelis believe in God at all. 85 to 90% of the Israelis are atheists or agnostics. So we are back in the land, but we're in unbelief. Now, this return in unbelief was already hinted at in chapter 36, verses 24 through 27, and in the vision of the dry bones in chapter 37, verses 1 through 4. So these chapters are the background to chapters 38 and 39. They consist of the background. Now, this restoration in unbelief is described in four ways. Point D1, it's a land brought back from the sword, and the Jewish people gained the land by war. In fact, we were involved in some 15 conflicts, and here they come. 1948, the Arab-Israeli War, November 47 to July 1949. Retribution operations in the 50s and 60s. Suez Crisis in October 1956, Six-Day War, June 1967, War of Attrition in 68 and 69 through 70, the Yom Kippur War, October 73, 78 South Lebanon Conflict in March of 78, the 82 Lebanon War, the South Lebanon Conflict from 82 to the year 2000, the First Intifada, 87 to 93, the Second Intifada, 2000 to 2005, the 2006 Lebanon War, the Gaza War, the Operation Pillar of Defense in 2012, and Operation Protective Edge in 2014. It's a land bought back from the sword, and the sword is still poised over the land. Point D2, it's a land that is gathered out of many peoples, and we Jews have returned from around 90 different nations, and here's that very famous picture of Operation Magic Carpet, bringing Yemenite Jews out of Yemen in 1949-1950. Thirdly, it's a land with mountains that have been a continual waste for 2,000 years. You know, that's what Mark Twain saw when he witnessed in his journey to Israel. He wrote about it in Innocents Abroad, and you can get this quote on Wikipedia from Innocents Abroad. Mark Twain writes, "We traversed some miles of desolate country." Notice the key word there, desolate. This land has been a desolation, a continual waste. And that's exactly what he saw. "We traversed some miles of desolate country whose soil is rich enough, but is given wholly to weeds, a silent, mournful expanse." A desolation is here that not even imagination can grace with the pomp of life and action. We reached Tabor safely. We never saw a human being on the whole route. We pressed on toward the goal of our crusade, renowned Jerusalem. The further we went, the hotter the sun got, and the more rocky and bare and repulsive and dreary the landscape became. A desolation, folks. There was hardly a tree or shrub anywhere. Even the olive and the cactus, those fast friends of a worthless soil, had almost deserted the country. No landscape exists that is more tiresome to the eye than that which bounds the approaches to Jerusalem. Jerusalem is a mournful, dreary, lifeless. I would not desire to live there. It is a hopeless, dreary, heartbroken land. And then his so picturesque closing statement there. Palestine sits in sackcloth and ashes. Yes, Palestine, Israel, sat in sackcloth and ashes, mourning her people, mourning the dispersion of her people through all the countries in the world. Now, this was written in 1869, just after our Civil War, 1869, a good number of years ago. And it was written just as the modern Zionist movement was gathering steam. Isn't that interesting? Just as the modern Zionist movement was getting off the ground in Europe. Here is Mount Tabor, as Mark Twain would have seen it in 1869. Not a soul living there, just scrub. Here is Mount Carmel in 1869, as it would have been observed by Mark Twain. This is where Haifa is located today. There's no city there. There's a couple of buildings up on the top of Mount Carmel, but that's about it. Here is Jerusalem, around the same era, 1895 or so. And notice the Judean hills beyond Jerusalem, barren. The city is very small, very few people living there. However, this is the Jezreel Valley today. This is the valley that Mark Twain would have gone through to get to Mount Tabor. It isn't desolate and unfarmed anymore, full of farms. And there's a major Israeli Air Force base there. And here is Mount Tabor as it looks today. Deserted? Hardly. Look at all the cities surrounding Mount Tabor. Mark Twain never saw those. Here is Haifa today. Not that barren wasteland you saw in the previous picture, but now Israel's major harbor. This is Jerusalem today, teeming with people. This is the Judean hills today. I'm looking from Kiryat Sha'arim back to the east, Jerusalem in the background. And notice the hills of Judea covered with trees, covered with homes. Jerusalem is a major city. The land is no longer a continual waste. Point four, it's a land brought forth out of the peoples, a land brought forth out of a worldwide dispersion. And that's what's been happening. Here's a picture of a nefesh by nefesh, soul by soul, person by person program. These are young American Jewish kids, young American Jews coming to Israel to immigrate and live in the land. Even from the United States, we get immigrants into Israel, a land brought forth out of the peoples. So all of these statements are true of present-day Israel. The waste places have been rebuilt and resettled. And again, here's another picture of those Judean hills. This is Ein Kerem, nestled in the hills of southwest Jerusalem. And notice the hills are again covered with trees now, and there are houses and buildings all over the place. The land is no longer deserted and desolate. All right, let's turn now to chapter 38, verses 10 through 12. And we come to the purpose for the invasion. In verse 10, we see Gog plan the invasion. Verse 10. Thus says the Lord God, it will come about on that day that thoughts will come into your mind, and you will devise an evil plan. The point of this verse is that the invasion is premeditated and carefully planned out by Gog. whoever he is, whoever he will be, he thinks this through and plans it out very carefully. The plan is described in verse 11. And you will say, I will go up against the land of unwalled villages. I will go against those who are at rest, that live securely, all of them living without walls and having no bars or gates. So he's going to go up against the land of unwalled villages. He's going to attack an Israel that is experiencing security and confidence. That's the idea here. No walls around the villages speak of security and confidence. And let me share with you an experience I had on one of my trips to Israel. I was leading a tour to Israel, a study tour to Israel, and one of my students was supposed to be sitting to my right in the middle seat on the plane, and then another student next to her. But for some reason, some seats got switched, and at the last minute, an Israeli man, Moshe, sat between me and my student on the far right. And we enjoyed talking with him. We got to know Moshe a little bit and enjoyed talking with him. And he was about my age, and he had fought in just about all of Israel's wars. And I made the remark to him, Moshe, I said, I think God has protected Israel through all those wars. Well, here's a picture of Moshe and my other student, I forget her name. Moshe made a response to that comment. Moshe, I think God protected Israel throughout all those wars. What did Moshe say? He looked at me and he said, there is no God. We did it. We have the power. There is no God. We did it. We have the power. Now that is a confident response. If that's not a confident response, I don't know what is, you guys. Moshe is confident that Israel can take care of herself. And that is a pretty typical attitude among the Israelis today. Now in these verses, we see the interplay between God's sovereignty and man's free will. We see a divine side, we see a human side. On the divine side, we see God's sovereignty when he says, in the latter days. That speaks of his foreknowledge. God is not limited by time. He's unlimited. He created time. He can move throughout time with effortlessly. He controls time. So that speaks of his sovereignty. He knows what's going to happen thousands and thousands and millions of years in the future. And then he also says, I will turn you about. I'll put hooks in your jaws. That speaks of his omnipotence. He can't be controlled by men. Men are controlled by him. So that is the divine side of the argument between, or the paradox, I should say, between God's sovereignty and man's free will. Now, then we see a human side. The human side is that Gog makes responsible decisions. He is going to make a premeditated and carefully planned out invasion. And he will be held responsible and accountable for that invasion. God will judge him. So both God's sovereignty and man's free will work together to accomplish God's plan. They work together. Now, I like to think of this as train tracks. Here's a picture of some train tracks. And a train has to run on those two tracks in order to get to its destination, right? Needs both of them. And in the same way, God has set it up so that his will, his plan, runs on two tracks. They're parallel. They never meet. One track is God's sovereignty. We can call that the track on the right side here. We can label it the sovereignty of God. But on the other side of the coin, we've got the free will of man. Men make responsible decisions. God is never caught by surprise on anything. That's his sovereignty. But men make responsible decisions. You and I make responsible decisions. We're not puppets. We're not puppets, and God is pulling our string. Well, how do those two truths work together? They seem contradictory. Well, they're a paradox, you guys. But you know, something does hold those true truths together so that they work in harmony. And what is that? We learned that in Colossians 1:17. He, Yeshua, is before all things, and in him all things hold together. Yeshua is the railroad ties that hold the two tracks together. Notice the picture. These two independent tracks are held together by the railroad ties, and so the train can get to its destination. In the same way, the sovereignty of God and the free will of man are held in coordination. God set it up this way, guys. Don't argue with me about it. That's the way he did it. God set it up this way, so man's free will and the sovereignty of God work together to perform God's plan. It's a paradox, and we have to learn to love paradox. You know, a modern Western mind tends to hold ideas in opposition. It can only be one way or the other way, white or black, black or white. Can't be anything in the middle. But the ancient Eastern mind tended to harmonize ideas. And you see an example of that thinking in Fiddler on the Roof. If you haven't seen Fiddler on the Roof, you should watch it. But Reb Tevye, when his daughters are contemplating marriage, says, on the one hand, but on the other hand. He's always thinking about both sides of the issue and trying to bring them into coordination and harmony. And this is the way the rabbis, solved the problem of God's sovereignty and man's free will. In the Mishnah Avot 3:16, you'll find the statement, all is foreseen. Well, that's a recognition and a bowing of the head to the sovereignty of God. All is foreseen. But the verse goes on. But freedom of choice is given. And that is a nod to the free will of man. So I think that's the attitude we Westerners need to adopt. Adopt the same attitude of the rabbis, because it's a biblical attitude. All is foreseen, the sovereignty of God. But freedom of choice is given, the free will of man. I hope that'll resolve it for you. That's how I've always resolved it, and I think that's the way the Bible would resolve it. All right, our next page is verse 12. And in chapter 38, verse 12, we come to the purpose for the invasion. Four reasons why Gog invades Israel. God goes on to speak, you will capture spoil. You come to capture spoil and seize plunder, to turn your hand against the waste places which are now inhabited, and against the people who are gathered from the nations, who have acquired cattle and goods, and who live at the center of the world. So here we see four reasons why Gog invades. One, to take spoil. This refers to the spoils of war. He will economically benefit. He's interested in economic gain. Secondly, to take prey. This word means to plunder through military victory. To plunder through military victory. In other words, he'll gain national prestige. He will once again be a superpower, maybe the superest of superpowers, maybe the top superpower. Thirdly, he comes to turn his hand against the waste places that are now inhabited. He wants to destroy the nation of Israel. He doesn't realize it, but he's coming against the land promise of the Abrahamic covenant. So he wants to violate the Abrahamic covenant and destroy the nation as it exists. And number four, he wants to come against the people. He wants to destroy the Israelis themselves. He wants to commit genocide. And the Israelis are described very accurately, gathered out of the nations, and they've gotten cattle, livestock, goods, material wealth. So the Israelis are described as being prosperous. And then point C, very important description of the Israelis, that dwell in the middle of the earth. Now, the term there is literally, in the Hebrew, the navel of the world. But the point is that Israel will be a very, very influential nation. She will be one of the most influential nations on earth, if not the most influential nation on earth during this invasion. Now, at this point, you have a handout in your, or you could have downloaded a handout, or you have a handout in your packet of handouts. It's a chart that I ran off in 2010 when I did this class earlier. It's a chart of Israeli contributions to the world. It's a very, very long chart. And now it's 2015. We're 5 years down the road here. And so that chart is going to be even longer. But you'll just get a hint of Israeli contributions to the world through that chart. All right. Israel is continuing to become more and more and more influential as the years go by. Now, some observations that Dr. Fuchsenbaum lays out for us. First of all, the key purpose is spoil. Material gains, riches. That's the key purpose that Gog initiates this invasion. Now, the text is silent regarding the content of the spoil, because cattle and goods and silver and gold are all general terms for the spoils of war. And of course, prophecy boffins have made lots of speculation around this point. Is it oil? Is it gas? Is it minerals? Is it all three? Is it technology? Who knows what it is? Well, it doesn't really matter. Whatever Israel has is going to be very, very valuable to Gog, and if we see this invasion in our lifetime, we will figure it out. The point is, all of this is in Gog's self-interest. In other words, he has a view of Israel. He views Israel as a choice raspberry ripe for the picking. I thought this was a good way to illustrate that here. This person is out picking raspberries, and there's a beauty, great, big, luscious, and red. Oh, I want that raspberry. And that's exactly what Gog is going to be thinking. I want that nation and all that she has to offer. All right. We've now come to verse 13 and the protest. It's now revealed that a group of nations protest the invasion. But verse 13 is rather long, and I see we only have a few moments left. So rather than getting into verse 13 and having to stop in the middle of the verse or keep you late, I think what I'll do is call it quits right here for this session, and we'll pick up our next session with the protest, the group of nations that protest the invasion. So we'll see you next session. Have a good day.